The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So it became clear to me that this was kind of unusual. So I was kind of curious, or just kind of became curious. And I don't know what I thought, but that is interesting. So I continued not to say anything for a long time. And I was wondering what was going to happen. But not wondering too much. I was just sitting there, quite content. It seemed like a pretty good time. And what was needed? Nothing was needed, right? I sat there, looked around a little bit, sat there, you know, like this. And no one got up and left. And no one complained. And no one said anything. And so after quite a long time means, I don't know what, 10 or 15 minutes or something, I said, if you're waiting for something, you've missed the boat. So if you're waiting for something, you missed the boat. Because in this practice here, the idea is to find your peace here and now. If you're waiting for it to happen, you've missed something that's happening here. You've missed an opportunity to connect and be present for something that's here. And so, if in this rare situation that the speaker doesn't speak, then what? Where's the practice then? Where do you practice then? And do you practice waiting? Do you practice wondering what's wrong? Do you practice getting angry? I came here to learn something important. Maybe the most important thing is for you to learn something about yourself when nothing happens. And, you know, when we meditate, it's really important, right? So that's okay to have nothing happen then, because we're doing something really important. But when we finish meditating, and is it okay for nothing to happen? Is that okay? So what comes up for people? You know, what are the concerns, the fears, the agendas, the needs? There's a lot of things that come up. So I thought that was a wonderful evening that many, and I, you know, it wasn't something I ever planned, so I would never plan that, but it just kind of happened. But so it kind of happened a little bit now with the speakers, right, that we couldn't get into work, the mic, so I thought I'd tell you that story in case you were waiting. So what I wanted to do today is to read to you a very early Buddhist text or a poem. It's considered by some to be among the very earliest, oldest literature in Buddhism. And what's unique about this particular poem, it begins with the Buddha talking about kind of what motivated him to practice, or how he felt before he started practicing, and what he discovered in his practice. And it does so in emotional terms. And the Buddha in the ancient literature mostly seems like a pretty even-minded guy, even-keeled guy. But here you get a sense of his inner, maybe struggle or inner angst or something. And I thought to me, when I read this, I'm kind of touched by the humanity of it, and how even in our modern life, modern time, someone might feel the same way. And maybe some of you have felt the same way. And it's in a discourse. The discourse itself is given the title Violence. Violence gives birth to fear. Just look at people and their quarrels. I will speak of my dismay and the way that I was shaken. Seeing people thrashing about like fish in little water, and seeing them in conflict with each other, I became afraid. The world is completely without a core. Everywhere things are changing. Wanting a place of my own, I saw nothing not already taken. I felt discontent at seeing only conflict to the very end. Then I saw an arrow here, hard to see, embedded in the heart. Pierced by this arrow, people dash about in all directions. When the arrow is pulled out, they do not run and they do not sink. That touching a little bit? The Buddha talking about his dismay, talking about how he became afraid. And this is before he became awakened, before he maybe started his journey. In the myth of Buddhism, it says the Buddha encountered sickness, old age, and death. But I think that whole story of him leaving the palace is a myth that was created. And in fact, apparently there are none of the early records say that this happened to the Buddha. The earliest records has the Buddha saying this happened to a mythic Buddha in the past. And then there became, down through the centuries, it came this idea that all the Buddhas had to follow the same pattern of life. And so if that happened to the ancient Buddha, then certainly it must have happened to the historical Buddha, that he also kind of saw the three sights as he left the palace. Anyways, myths are wonderful, and so that's a wonderful Buddhist myth that we have. But this here feels closer to, you know, not a myth, but actually what a human being, you know, struggles or difficulties, and what a human being might actually, have. And I think many people look about their lives and they see violence, they see fighting, they see that everything's changing. And sometimes people get distressed and feel it's only because of this age and time. But it's maybe always been this way. It's been better before. It was better in the past. And one of the common refrains that seems to come up in every generation is people nowadays are so selfish. These people. And, if you go back, you see that people said that regularly. Recently I was reminded of this when I read a quote from an ancient Roman philosopher. People these days, they're so selfish. Now maybe it goes in waves, people's selfishness, but I think probably it's every generation, you know, looks back or sees the next generation, you know, how could these young people be so self-concerned and caught up in their own desires and things, and they seem like they're an anomaly. But it's, you know, when every generation says that, and probably people said it about their generation when they were younger or something. So, you know, and so we feel like, you know, things are getting worse. But the Buddha lived in a violent time. And I don't know what he was encountering when he talked about this, but there was his area of northern India. That was a time when before that there were these smaller kingdoms and republics and tribal units. And then in the period around his life, people of the king started consolidating their power and conquering the neighboring powers and creating bigger and bigger states. And then these kings would fight each other. And the Buddha's own homeland was apparently attacked, and we don't quite know if it was still in his lifetime or right after he died. There was apparently some massive massacre. They say that the Buddha's time also was a time of urbanization, because as they consolidated these kingdoms, they created these bigger urban cities. Some of the guilds and crafts started getting concentrated, and you had the rise of business and trading and kind of crafts guilds and things that was very new compared to a more subsistence agrarian culture and society. So everything was changing. And so violence and consolidation and fighting and society as they knew it was changing radically, and urban culture was rising. And I don't know if every generation changes as much, but it's certainly, you know, in the last couple hundred years, few hundred years, we've had a tremendous amount of change in the world, and the change continues right to today, and the violence continues. And is there no end to the violence? You know, it's supposed to be the war that ends war, and finally, you know, the one that's going to end it all. And who knows, is it really going to end it? Now that Benghazi has been saved, that's going to end the, is that going to end the fighting? You know, or it's going to go on, and who knows where it's going to go? And then, you know, this world that's seemingly so stable, how stable is it? You know, in some of our lifetimes, we've seen tremendous change. Countries come and go. The Soviet Union is no longer there. Eastern Europe has changed dramatically in our lifetime. Now the Middle East is changing dramatically. I grew up on the edges of Yugoslavia, on the border. We used to go across the border to buy butter. It was that close. And gas, and you know, it was like a, you know, just, I was right on the border. And Yugoslavia doesn't exist anymore. You know, a country that I was, you know, familiar with. And so change, and is it getting worse? I mean, you know, my own parents went through World War II, and my parents-in-law went through the concentration camps in Germany. And so they went through huge upheavals and change, and they experienced their instability at a young age. So we meet this world, and so how do we, you know, and so the Buddha felt dismay and felt afraid. And that's a common reaction. It's a very human reaction. And I think it's appropriate to have a lot of care, respect, compassion for the tremendous strong impact that the world can have on a human heart. And so the Buddha, apparently, it was no different than that. So he felt discontent, the way it's translated here, seeing only conflict to the very end. But then, he says at the end, then I saw an arrow. Some translators translate it as barb. Maybe barb makes more sense because it's smaller. Then I saw a barb, because it fits in the heart better. Then I saw an arrow here, hard to see, embedded in the heart. Pierced by this arrow, people dash about in all directions. When the arrow is pulled out, they do not run, and they do not sink. So what the Buddha is doing is really kind of a dramatic shift of, rather than looking at the problem or the solution in the world outside, he's turning around and looking at his own heart. And that's where he found something that was, you know, very significant. And the whole revolution, the whole kind of radical offering that Buddhism offers, began when the Buddha was able to find in his own heart the arrow, the barb, what was piercing it. And then, more important than that, he saw it was possible to take this out. And as long as we had that barb in us, then he says here, people run about, dash about in all directions. The earlier image is quite strong. I think the image of a fish in little water, in shallow water. You ever seen a fish kind of, you know, flapping around? It's kind of a dramatic image, right? So people that way. And so, you know, what is it that causes that? And you could say it's the world outside, the conditions outside, and only if the world was different, then I could live safely. But I think the radical suggestion of Buddhism is that certainly you should help make the world a better place, but the real issue is what's in your own heart. And that's what triggers the fear, the thrashing about, the running around. And I certainly have met lots of people where it's very obvious that they are not willing to be present for themselves. There's some pain, there's a sorrow, there's a wound, there's some discomfort. There's something they don't want to look at. And as they don't want to look at it, they run around in circles, or they run around. They get involved in addictive behavior. They get really busy, very busy with work, or very busy with social relationships, or very busy with entertainment, television, anything, and they kind of run around busy all the time. So to turn around and look, and what is it that's embedded in our hearts? What's embedded in there? And perhaps for each person something a little different, but the point being that the fear, the dismay, the discontent that can really get us to be contracted resides in our own hearts or in our own minds. And And so the task in Buddhism is it's really useful to take that out, to take responsibility for what's in here, to find the roots of not only our own distress, but also the way in which people behave in the world here in us. Someone has to do it. When after 9/11, right after 9/11, there was two friends of mine who went off to sit a three-month retreat, you know, within a week after 9/11 or something, and 10 years ago. And I said to them, I made a point to go find them before they went. I said, you know, after something such a big thing as 9/11, it might feel like you can't, this is not really a time to go off and do a three-month retreat. You might feel, you know, your friends, family, country needs you. This is a time to stay present and be with the world, the country, when it's going through this big upheaval and change. And it might seem like it's selfish to go off, you know, everyone's suffering, and it might be selfish to go off on retreat. And I said, it's really important. It's one of the best things you can do, because we need to have some people who sit still enough, quiet enough, mindful enough, to go down to the depths of their own hearts and really find what's there and clarify it and purify it and bring out what's most beautiful that's there. And if there aren't at least a few people who do it in each generation, then maybe there's no hope. We're all going to run around. And it's really powerful. There are people who can really turn around and do that kind of work. And whether you go a little bit in there and pull out that barb a little bit, or you go all the way and extract it completely, the fact that people turn towards it and look at it and do it, I think is such a beautiful thing and powerful thing. It can be a source of tremendous joy to know that you have a path, know there's a practice that can help us do this. Because the other way of trying to fix the world, you know, I don't know. If we all hope, right? If only, you know. But people have been trying for a long time. And of course, we should go try to help the world the best we can. But I believe we help the world. One of the ways we help the world is to have done the inner work so that we can meet the world calmly and peacefully, so we can meet what's going on and support people, help people, through our own ability to be calm, peaceful in the midst of difficulties and distress. If we keep running around in dismay and you know, we can't really help people. There was a powerful image that Thich Nhat Hanh gave when he was helping the people leaving Vietnam and escaping Vietnam in the 70s and the 80s. And they would leave Vietnam in these really rickety boats and filled with people. You know, apparently the water level was just right up to the edge of the, you know, the boat. So, and then if a wind came or if some waves came, it would, you know, the boat would capsize. And a lot of people were lost at sea. And Thich Nhat Hanh says that, you know, if the weather got kind of rough, you know, the last thing you want to do is have all the people get excited on the boat, you know, running around and we got to do something, you know, and so what he said was, if one person can stay calm, it keeps everybody else calm. And that's a powerful image. You know, I don't know if he was making it up or it was a real story of someone who's, but if one person can stay calm, it can have a ripple out and affect everyone else and creates, you know, some stability. So one of the hallmarks of Buddhism down through the ages that is to look as a spiritual tradition is to look towards, is to emphasize or point back towards the heart or to the mind as being the genesis and the source of this life of ours that we live. And so the opening of the Dhammapada is kind of like the Buddhist genesis. At least it's a nice contrast to the Judeo-Christian genesis, where it's in the Bible it says, you know, in the beginning there was God. So that's where it all begins. That's the emphasis. And so the focus is to turn towards God in a certain way. In Buddhism, the Dhammapada begins by saying the mind is the forerunner of all things. It begins with the mind or the heart. And so it's a kind of, in some ways, a very different approach. Doesn't have to be, or there's a way of kind of seeing them as very similar, but at least explicitly, very different approach, where the emphasis is not to look externally for the truth or for salvation or for the answer, but to look for the answer in the heart, to look in ourselves. So we sit and meditate, and this is one of the functions of meditation. It's not just to make ourselves calm and to reduce our stress. I always felt it was kind of strange when I read about generals in the Pentagon who were taking up meditation. I mean, you know, I'm glad for them. And I'm sure it's good for them. I met a beautiful man who actually worked at the Pentagon. He came on retreat, and he was a beautiful man, and he was really genuinely trying to bring peace to the world, and he was trying to make a real difference in the culture and the whole approach of the Pentagon, and trying to prevent wars was really what he was there trying to do. But anyway, but at least, the idea that you'd use meditation to be calmer and more stress-free so you can be a better soldier, it somehow doesn't quite work for me. And but we sit still in order to go deep inside and look what's here. And then I think of meditation, I thought a little bit like, it's kind of like a wind tunnel. And you put something in a wind tunnel and you see where all the resistance is and the wind drag is. You put yourself in the meditation wind tunnel, and sooner or later you'll start seeing where the wind drag is. And you start understanding where, and the wind drag is where you're attached, what you're holding on to, what you're clinging, what you're resisting. And there's a variety of things that can cause wind drag and slow us down, can be this resistance to just life as it flows through us. And one of them, the Buddhist, so I list four of the things that the Buddhist tradition puts tremendous emphasis on. And maybe these are some of the barbs that maybe some people will find in themselves, the arrows. So one is the attachment to being comfortable, and the attachment to pleasure, sensual pleasure. And it can seem like a lot of people say, well, I'm not attached to sensual pleasure. But actually, it's a very powerful force in our society. And people, so one example that I don't know how well this will work, but so in our kind of corner of the world here, it's recognized as a relatively affluent place. Not that everyone's affluent by any means, but relatively. And so I bet there's a fair percentage of you all who live in a house that's bigger than it really needs to be. And why do you live in a house that's bigger than it needs to be? Well, because it's more pleasant. It's more enjoyable. And what do you do so you can live in a house that's more pleasant and more enjoyable? Well, you take an extra job, or you try to, take out a bigger loan, and you do this sacrifice, and do all this. There's a lot of effort goes in to pay for that rent or that mortgage or whatever. A lot of extra work. It could be said, then, I would think, that there's a certain attachment or clinging or drive to pleasantness or pleasure which are underlying some of the choices about how a person lives their life. So could that be true with other things in your life? Some of the things you don't really need, but why do you do them? Why do you do these things? Because they bring pleasure, you feel more comfortable. There are some people who have a policy in their mind, unconsciously perhaps, that only if things are pleasant and comfortable is everything okay. Only if they're pleasant and comfortable are we successful, or we're right, or something. So the attachment to pleasure and comfort is said to be one of the forms of wind drag. Maybe that's, maybe you like that image. It's two images, right? You could choose. Wind drag or arrow in your heart. So the second one is the usual way of describing Buddhism is attachment to opinions and to views. I like to sometimes translate it as attachment to your stories. Because views and opinions, you know, that's like philosophy and, you know, your politics and all that. But your stories, I mean, what, you know, what happened to me and what's, you know, we have this whole narrative about our life and what we need and all this stuff. And just, you know, mostly just an opinion anyway. But, you know, but you don't see it as an opinion if I say that word, it's a story. So we're attached to a story. And or the story of our people or my family or what happened to me earlier, or story about how life's supposed to be. And there's all these stories we tell ourselves. And, or we've told, our society tells us stories. Tells us stories of what it means to be successful. The American dream, supposedly, was a story, right? And people bought into that story, that if you'd be happy and successful if you bought into that dream. And so another one of these wind drag is having a certain kind of grasping to stories and opinions. So as we sit and meditate, as we get quieter and quieter, the stories that we're attached to will continue to operate. It's hard to just stop something because you're meditating if you're attached to it. So they'll start appearing, they'll bubble up. They'll appear as unresolved issues or as frustration or as a drive or preoccupation. And so you've got to feel that and see, and you're in your wind tunnel, and you see, wow, there's a lot of wind drag. And so then it's your choice, you know. You could, you know, begin changing the shape of the of you, or you could get a bigger engine for your airplane and blast through better. And some people choose the, you know, the blasting through, and some people get a Prius. So, you know, it has less wind drag. Something like that. So the third attachment is, and this is a really big wind drag, and that is your self-image. Attachment to self-concepts, self-ideas, the way you represent yourself to yourself, the way you want to represent yourself to the world around you. We make try to make ourselves safe, we try to get what we want in the world by having people see us a certain way. And so often there's a kind of, people can kind of maneuver and say things and do things and act in ways in order to have an impression so people see you a certain way. It's said that sometimes that many people give more care to what they wear than what they say, you know, because of the impression it's giving. And so as we get quiet and still, if we're attached to self, to self-concept, that appears in the mind as a form of agitation. And that agitation will start feeling uncomfortable. And so part of the function of meditation is to learn how to relax and to soften, and hopefully not just relax and soften, but pull out the barb to eliminate that area of wind drag. So to find a different way of relating to self, different way of being in the world, where self-concept, self-image, self-representation, self-identity are not something we're grasping and holding on to. In a sense, the self is a, you know, a special kind of opinion, a special kind of story. So it has its own category in this list. And then the fourth, the final one, is it's a little bit obscure, difficult, I think, without some explanation, but it's the attachment, the Buddhist English way of saying it, it's attachment to becoming. And one of the ways of its attachment, one way of understanding is attachment to existence, to being alive. And that's kind of, you know, like, that's kind of discouraging. You know, you know. You know, now I'm not supposed to be alive, or what's the alternative? But rather, the attachment to not being alive is as bad as attachment to being alive in Buddhism. The solution is not to be against life, but rather not to be attached to it. And the attachment to living is, and the fear of death is a very powerful one. And so to somehow begin feeling how that's wind drag, how it slows us down, And what I like about this image of Windrag, or maybe perhaps of the arrow, is that we're not talking about a should. We're not saying, there's not like a moral obligation. It isn't like someone says, you know, that, you know, you'll be a better person or something if you do this work. But rather, if you're sensitive and feel, you'll feel the resistance, you'll feel the suffering, the pain of it. And then it's really good news that there's a practice, techniques in a way, of working with it and freeing yourself of it. This is really the good news of Buddhism. So the one of the words in this poem is the word dismay. The Buddha said, violence gives birth to fear. Just look at people and their quarrels. I will speak of my dismay. The word is translated dismay is a Pali word, samvega. And it's a very important word in the Buddhist tradition. S-A-M-B-E-G-A-A. Samvega. And it's a dismay doesn't quite capture it. Maybe there's no English word that really captures what this means. But it's a combination of feeling a certain kind of unease, discontent with the condition of our world, the situation of human life as we encounter it, and the motivation to practice to overcome that discontent or to find the alternative. Sometimes they emphasize more the sense of the discontent or the tiredness. I'm tired of all this. I'm tired of all this running around doing all this stuff and building up my sense of self and putting up all these walls and trying to get all my ducks lined up all the time. And once in a while I get everything lined up and everything's perfect. It just, you know, and then it falls down again. And then I have to do it again. And it just goes on and on. Or we see the violence in the world and it's just so disturbing. People suffering all over. And so some people emphasize that part. But if you only emphasize that part, it can be discouraging. It can be kind of depressing. But there's the other part, I think, which is really encouraging, which is the part, it's motivating for practice. Yes, let's do this work. Let's go on the path. We say we don't find a path of practice that often. There's many messages, many paths offered in life which take us away from the heart. And so here there's a path, this beautiful path. It's a path of clarifying and purifying and finding love and compassion and finding a deep inner peace. And it's so beautiful to find it. And so samvega is what gives us the courage or the inspiration or a lot of strength and power to walk on that path. It's meant to be energizing and to have this samvega. So there's something about encountering the world and seeing it for what it is that is not supposed to be distressing in the end, but rather be energizing in a good way. Just like compassion, it can be energizing to do a lot of good in the world, but you don't feel compassion unless you feel a suffering of the world. And that's the kind of thing about compassion comes together with suffering. Samvega comes together with seeing the condition of this world, certain aspect of this world, how it is, and then seeing that there's an alternative. And so the Buddha was a living example of an alternative. Down through the ages, there's been many people who have practiced and are examples of that alternative. And the hope is that you become an example of that alternative, that you become an example of someone who understands him or herself so well that you understand what's deep in your heart. The deepest resistance, the deepest attachments, the deepest holdings, the deepest fears, and that you have learned, you've discovered how to pluck out those attachments, to have the courage to live without those attachments. That's a beautiful thing to do. And so the teachings of Buddhism, the techniques of Buddhism, the practices of Buddhism, it's all there in place to offer support, and more important than support and encouragement for doing that work, so that we have hope, so that we have a really possibility for making a difference at the root of where the problems begin. So I hope that was okay. And we have maybe 5 minutes, so maybe one or two questions or comments if anyone would like to make. Victor, who just came back from sitting for a whole month.
Questions regarding?
Did I say something before about why it was so important for you to sit for a whole month?
Well, I had this... I enjoy retreats, and as difficult as they can be, it's always fruitful in one respect or another. I just intuitively knew that, in this case, longer was better. Also, I might not have too many opportunities to sit long retreats in the future. We never know what the future may bring. I wholeheartedly recommend sitting a month retreat every 30 days or so. I think it's a good prescription or remedy for many things. And it seems that the longer time you're able to settle, more things, you're just able to explore and unearth more things. You get more and more quiet, and it's really extraordinary. It's just
made a difference for you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's great.
Are you ready to face your challenges better?
Well, I've been ready for
a while.
But it's, I was able to see the aspect of impermanence much better, and working with the aggregates sort of very specifically. Okay. It was very difficult to do that just in a shorter retreat because just wasn't enough time to get settled to see those things come up.
Do you have a question?
I have a question on non-existence. Craving, I don't understand the aspect of craving non-existence.
So as I know it, there's two general ways of interpreting. There's the attachment to becoming and attachment to non-becoming. And it's a little too complicated, but the simplest way in English to say it is existence and non-existence. And the one non-existence, in terms of human life, existence means attachment to living. Attachment to non-living, to non-existence, would be someone who is suicidal, for example. Enough of this, I'm out of here, this is too much, you know, I just want to not feel. I don't want to experience it anymore. I want just enough. So that's one interpretation. The other interpretation of this, these pair, is that it's an attachment to identity and non-identity. So, like, I have my thing, you know, in terms of being. I don't know if this is quite accurate, but I have a thing about. In some ways, I'm more attached to non-identity than identity. So, for example, it takes a form of, I really don't want to wear a T-shirt that has any kind of sign on it, or emblem, or logo, or, you know, because, you know, that's like, please, you know, I want to be invisible, or I don't want to stand out, I don't want to have an identity. Like, but my son, I mean, he's so happy to have, you know, all these logos, you know, blasting across his chest, you know, these stores. I can't believe it. You know, you're walking advertisement. You paid all this, you paid all this money for this. So, you know, so the idea of, so some people are more attached to not having identity. And sometimes in the Buddhist circle, maybe I'm an example of it, but in Buddhist circles, you find sometimes people getting stuck and caught with the idea that Buddhism is teaching not self, and so I'm not supposed to be anybody. And I don't want to be anybody, and, you know, just they kind of, you know. And this non-identity, attachment to not having identity is as much a problem as attachment to having identity. So what's left, right? You know, if you can't have it, you know, that what's left is not to be attached to either. But it's okay to have an identity. I mean, we all have some kind of identity. I mean, you know, your gender, your sexual orientation, your ethnicity, your, you know, there's all kinds of ways in which you can be But, you know, it's not something that you hold tightly to, which is not something that you, you know, just it is when it's there, and it's not when it's not there, then, you know, things change. Who knows how things change? So then there's a third interpretation of this becoming, non-becoming, existence, non-existence, and that is, it's much more general. It has to do with either desire for something to be or the desire for something not to be. So aversion, like pushing something away, so anything at all. And so now it's kind of almost universalized, you know, just a movement of for and against things. That's how it's understood. So that's my three ways I have an understanding for understanding it. And luckily there's an alternative. And that is not to be attached. And what needs to be said, I believe, is that is to reassure you that you can take care of your life better. You're actually safer if you don't get attached. But most people feel like it's not safe to let go of those. That's what keeps me safe and defended and protected and all that. But we become safer. Non-attachment, not clinging, is the place of safety. The Buddha actually says, later in the same long poem, he says, release of clinging, release is peace. Release is peace. Sorry? One of you will come next week and give me one. I'll put it on then. To show you I'm not attached. Yes.
Where did these attachments appear in the Buddhist literature?
This list.
This one. This four. This four.
Oh, I offhand I can't.
No, but it's one of the many lists.
Oh, yes. There's no shortage of lists. Attachment to lists is not one of the problems. Yes. Anyway, so thank you all, and I hope that you find your barb.